Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I am Jonathan Strickland, the host of Tech Stuff.
And I am Lauren Vogelbaum, the other host of Tech Stuff.
Yes. If we had introduced ourselves in the opposite order, I would be the other host of Tech Stuff.
We're co-hosts, really.
Yeah, it's this is a complicated issue, and in fact, I think it'd be a lot simpler if we just simulated it.
Would it be a lot simpler? I think it would actually be more complicated.
You know what? We're going to find out right here and now, because this episode is all about, do we live in a computer simulation? And in fact, the reason why we're even talking about this is a few years ago, a philosopher, and boy, is that a surprise to no one, a philosopher by the name of Nick Bostrom, who works at a little
place you might have heard of.
Yeah, tiny, like in academic circles, they have some swagger.
It's the University of Oxford.
Yeah, yeah, as far as the boffins go, it's Swagger City, right? Anyway, yeah, he works at the University of Oxford, and he's a philosopher employed there. So his job is to sit around and think about the nature of reality. And he presented an interesting thought experiment. He said, do we live in a computer simulation? Is everything that we experience and everything that's around us actually just the product of some sort of computer program in a universe larger than our own? And we'll talk about, you know, what led him into this kind of line of thinking and his arguments presenting the likelihood that we are actually in a computer simulation. But before we begin in that, I thought it'd be interesting to look back quite a ways, actually, because this idea that reality as we understand it is not exactly...
It's not new at all.
Yeah.
We've been pondering for basically as long as we could ponder things, whether or not our experience of reality is reality.
Yeah, and part of that is understandable. I mean, we know for a fact that reality consists of stuff that is beyond our perception, right?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Like, I don't know when the last time you looked into the infrared spectrum was, but the last time for me was never, because it's outside my visual acuity. I can't see in the infrared spectrum.
Right, and there's lots of things above our scale of hearing, above and below our scale of hearing.
Yep.
If you talk to sharks, they can hear different stuff. But
yeah, my dogs. Totally different stuff that I can hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even before we had as much scientific data about that as we do now, you know, if we had done the research, we could tell you the exact spectrums that we can see within. But
yeah.
Outside of visual, which is a pretty good word for it. But yeah, you know, it's even long, long, long times before that, people were pondering these questions in all kinds of literature. Goes into literature and philosophy.
Right, right. Back in 1641, one of the famous examples of this kind of philosophy was proposed by a fellow named René Descartes, about whom Monty Python had some rude things to sing, if you know your philosopher's song. But Descartes, I think therefore I am, fella, he wrote something called the Meditations on First Philosophy. And he presented a very similar thought exercise to the one that Nick Bostrom mentioned. Now, his was called the evil demon, or sometimes people refer to it as the evil genius problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, what if everything that I, René, I think therefore I am Descartes, experience is actually just an illusion that's generated by an evil force? In his case, he was talking about an evil demon. So there's this malevolent creature that is capable of creating everything that Descartes is experiencing. So while he thinks he's walking around and being really smart and chatting with other smart people and having a croissant, in reality, he's just a consciousness that's being manipulated by this evil demon, and everything that's happening to him is an illusion that's created by him. And this is unfalsifiable.
Right.
That means that there's no way that you can prove that it's wrong.
It's like if I say there's a 6-foot invisible bunny walking around behind me all the time.
Yeah.
That makes no noise and has no scent.
Right. And you can't touch it.
That you cannot touch.
Yeah. Well, there's no way for me to prove that you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I will sit here and I will think that you are crazy or Donnie Darko, but that, you know, or Deborah Darko, I don't know. I mean,
or the character in Harvey.
There you go.
There you
nice.
Go.
Another
that,
one.
Uh-huh.
Yes, but the, you know, there's no way for me to prove that there's not a 6-foot invisible, untouchable, unscentable, unhearable bunny behind you. So it's called unfalsifiable. That means it is not scientific.
Right.
Scientific principles, premises, these sort of things, they are falsifiable, meaning
right.
that there should be a set of criteria under which you would say this is not true.
Right.
Now, it does not mean that what you're saying isn't true. It just means it has to be possible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there has to be within the realm of possibility.
In order for something to be proved, it has to be able to be disproved.
Exactly. And so if it's unfalsifiable, it's not scientific. Now, I should also stress, if it's unfalsifiable and unscientific, that also does not mean it's
Not true.
It could be true.
It could absolutely be true.
String theory is a great example of
yes.
this. We call it a theory, but some people argue it's a philosophy.
Well, it's not a mathematical theory. And I get into arguments sometimes with people on Facebook about this, because the theory is a word that has many, many meanings.
Right.
The mathematical meaning of it is something that has been proven is true.
Whereas, you know,
has been exercised.
The whole scientific theory versus I have a theory,
right.
which is really more like I have an idea of why this is the way
yeah.
it is. Scientific theory and that kind of theory are two different things.
Yeah.
But anyway, string theory would say that the entire universe is made up of these tiny little vibrating strings. And we're talking like tiny as in tinier than subatomic particles tiny.
Quite
and,
small.
And that the way they vibrate, that's what makes stuff what it is.
Uh-huh.
Well, mathematically, this makes sense. But there is no way we can observe this or test this. So therefore, it's unfalsifiable and unscientific using that particular definition.
Sure.
So same sort of thing here with René Descartes and his theory. And this is, not the first time this idea has popped up, but it's one of the really famous ones, and that's back in 1641.
Right.
So if we look at the modern version, you've got Nick Bostrom talking about a computer simulation, and his whole argument hinges on this idea of transhumanism or the singularity. So we kind of have to talk about what the singularity is so that we can finally get around to this whole computer simulation problem.
Right. And also talk about transhuman.
Yeah.
Because that's basically a fancy term for stuff.
Yeah. It's a fancy term for saying what happens when we reach a point in advances in science and medicine, in biology, where we can transform ourselves to a point where we are no longer, strictly speaking,
human.
Right. Like, we have altered ourselves on some fundamental level, and we aren't – we wouldn't be human as we recognize it today.
Right. That our technology has bonded to us in a way, or yeah. that our science has bonded to us in
right.
a way.
Right. We've understood genetics enough so that we're all mutants, like in the X-Men, or we have all become cyborgs,
mm-hmm.
or we have all transmitted our consciousness into computers, and there are no physical versions of us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are all different ways that we could, in theory, become transhuman. So it's a very generic term that spreads across multiple possibilities.
Right.
There's no one transhuman outcome.
Yes, because really, I mean, the thing is that we don't know because we're not there yet.
Yeah, it hasn't happened yet, as it turns out. I mean, there's a few of us who are a little wacky, but it doesn't mean, you know. No.
Some of us are clearly better than others. I mean.
Okay, yeah.
But.
I mean, we're not naming names, but we're pretty awesome. So that's the idea of transhumanism. Singularity is sort of one of the pathways where we could reach this sort of transhuman future. And the singularity is this idea that several futurists have proposed about the fact that technology advances are continuing at a faster and faster pace each year, really.
Exponentially.
You've got things like Moore's Law where – depending on how you're defining it, essentially the computer power is doubling every 2 years. But other technological advances are happening at an even faster rate, that we will eventually come to a point where we are advancing continuously with no break between the generational...
Between shifts,
yeah.
Right.
Right. If you think of, like, operating systems and how they come out, like, you know, Windows 7 and then mm-hmm. Windows 8.
Once every 4 years or so, yeah, sure.
But then you think, all right, well, then down the road, it might be that every 6 months, and then it might be every 3 months, and then it might just be that every single day there's something new that's being incorporated.
Or every second, or every nanosecond,
right.
or et cetera.
So at that point, things are changing so fast that you cannot even define the era you are in, because
mm-hmm.
there's nothing, like, within one moment, you have changed so much that it's pointless to try and define a series of moments, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
At this point in our future, we would hit what is called the singularity. And part of one of the defining features of the singularity is it's impossible for us to say what will happen once we hit that point. Because by its very nature, it's going to evolve so fast that we cannot conceive
right.
of what can happen. I mean, it's kind of pointless to talk about it too much. Doesn't stop me, but it's pointless.
It doesn't stop philosophers either.
Doesn't stop me. And there are many pointless discussions that you cannot stop me from having. This is one of them. Anyway, so the singularity could happen in various ways. Again, biology, science, technology, these are all the different avenues that could lead to the singularity, or it could be, you know, a
little bit of everything. Sure.
Yeah. And that forms the very crux of Bostrom's argument.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices. And that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely? Where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. on the network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Take your work on the road, and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenny, Chief Marketing and Growth Officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time with the customers. That is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
And now back to the show.
So Nick Bostrom's argument is worded this way. Here's from a paper he wrote on the subject.
Okay.
A technologically mature post-human civilization would have enormous computing power. Based on this empirical fact, the simulation argument shows that at least one of the following propositions is true. One, the fraction of human-level civilizations that reach a post-human stage is very close to zero. Two, the fraction of post-human civilizations that are interested in running ancestor simulations is very close to zero. Or three, the fraction of all people with our kind of experiences that are living in a simulation is very close to one. Now, what that essentially means is that if we are able to reach a post-human phase, this transhuman phase where we have at our fingertips practically limitless resources.
Right.
Because of things are being so magical and rainbows are popping out of everything now. That if that's the case, then we should be able to create a computer simulation of the universe that is within the realm of the simulation itself extremely realistic.
Sure.
And that we could also create within this this universal simulation simulated intelligent beings, so that these created beings would have sentience, they'd have consciousness,
they might be very much like modern humans.
Yes, they'd be self-aware, mm-hmm. But they would exist within the context of this created universe, and so they would only be able to see the things that are within that universe.
Mm-hmm.
Anything outside of the universe, they would be incapable of perceiving.
Right.
So within that universe, it would seem like they were, quote unquote, the real people.
Right.
Right? They were the people who were there because of whatever forces caused the universe to be created in the first place. And that for these people within the simulated universe, it might be completely impossible for them to detect anyone outside of it, anyone being us, that we were the ones creating it. So his argument is that if we in fact reach this stage and if we would use our technology to create simulations so that we could see how civilizations develop, and that we would
see
definitely
how
do that.
Interesting bits of the universe work because we're intrinsically curious.
Right. So his argument is if it's possible, we would do it.
Yes.
And if it's possible and we would do it, that means we, the current people living in this universe,
are almost surely
a computer simulation. So if it can happen, and if we are interested in ourselves, and we obviously are, then it's almost a guarantee that we're in a computer simulation. And the reason for that argument is that in order for us to not be a computer simulation, we would have to be the first ones.
Right.
Right?
We'd have to be heading towards that timeline.
Right.
And just haven't gotten there yet.
Yep.
No Mr. Fusion.
Right. Whereas in every other case, some other post-human civilization has already gotten there and made at least one level of simulated universe, which means that one out of infinity means we're the first. And then every other example is we're number two or lower. So, yeah, that's kind of the crux of his argument. And it's really, again, a philosophical argument. It's not meant to say,
right,
we're in a computer game,
because the way that it's set up, yeah, the, you know, if you're saying that 99.999 ad infinitum percent of the time we're probably a computer simulation,
yeah,
it's you're placing the burden of proof on that 99.9 et cetera,
yeah,
percent of the population who might think you're wrong,
right,
and that
so but
isn't really fair.
It's an interesting question.
Oh, absolutely.
It's again, unfalsifiable at right now, but here's the funny thing. Bostrom makes this statement, but it's purely from a philosophical point of view, right? It's not from a physics point of view. It's not from a science point of view. It's philosophy. That has not stopped other people from looking at this from a scientific point of view. And that, to me, is another interesting aspect of this argument, is that usually you would look at an argument like this and say, okay, well, that's an interesting philosophical question. Ultimately, there's nothing I can do about that one way or the other. And then you go about your merry little way.
Right. But a bunch of nice, I'm assuming quantum scientists have gotten together.
Are you assuming they're nice or are you assuming they're quantum scientists?
I'm assuming both. I'm going to go ahead and give them the benefit of the doubt there.
Fair enough.
have been doing some research into quantum chromodynamics.
Yeah.
Which is a theory about one of the four fundamental forces in our universe.
Okay, so the four fundamental forces are strong nuclear force, electromagnetism, weak nuclear force, and gravity.
And that is, in fact, in the order of how powerful they are.
Right, gravity is the weakest. It's the one that we're having the most trouble incorporating into our model of mm-hmm. the universe. Strong nuclear force deals with the force of, you know, those nucleuses things, those nuclei that exist inside atoms?
Uh-huh.
You know how they have, like, stuff that's stuck together, like protons and neutrons?
And we're not sure why, because hypothetically, two protons should
push each other
push
away.
Push each other away, well, if you've ever played with magnets?
Well, strong nuclear force is the force, that's the name for the reason why these things are stuck together so strong. Why they're able to stick together. Clearly, it has to be an incredibly strong force.
It's an incredibly strong force that only kicks in incredibly short distances.
Right. We're talking on the atomic scale. Mm-hmm. So the strong nuclear force is what quantum chromodynamics is all about studying. And one of the ways that quantum chromodynamics, or QCD, which would be way easier to say, is to look at this as a part of it looks at reality as four space-time dimensions.
Right.
So four dimensions. We mentioned string theory earlier. Some versions of string theory require that there are no fewer than 11 dimensions for string theory to work.
Which is basically beyond my comprehension entirely. I get X, Y, Z, and time.
Yeah.
That I can get a three-dimensional object moving through time.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Beyond that, it gets a little wonky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, tiny-wimey.
Wibbly-wobbly. I'm right there with you. And yeah, same thing. And again, this plays back to that discussion we had at the very beginning where we talked about, you know, we know the universe consists of stuff that's beyond our perception. But, you know, we have to filter that through our brains, and our brains are acting as a middleman between our consciousness and reality. Mm-hmm. So the things that we experience may very well be, in their fundamental nature, extremely different from the way we think of them, because it's being filtered through.
Because we have to model them in this
this
flawed
is hurting my head, man.
Concept.
We shouldn't have done this. Philosophy makes me sad. I just realized that my brain is what's making – you sit there and you think, like, think about it. If you have a bad day, you're thinking, wait a minute. Part of the reason I'm having a bad day is because my brain is filtering things in. It's my fault. And then I just – it becomes this
and
vicious cycle.
And terrible loop of everything is terrible because of my brain, which is making things terrible.
A little glimpse into Jonathan Strickland there, folks. This is how I get just before I have to go to CES. I know this episode publishes after I come back, but trust me.
Morose.
Day after tomorrow. Man, it's rough.
It's a terrible life having to fly around the country and look at really shiny technological objects.
You are not helping this vicious cycle that's going on. Getting back to QCD.
Yes.
So part of this is looking at reality as four space-time dimensions, and it's using computers that are really, really powerful to do this, and creating something that's it's called a lattice gauge. It's lattice gauge theory, actually, that is sort of the framework within which QCD tries to explain the strong nuclear force. And this part of this means that we try and simulate an incredibly tiny simulated universe.
Oh, right. And this is on the actually the femto scale.
Yeah,
am I saying that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. And a femtometer is 1/4 of a meter.
Yeah.
A nanometer, for reference, is 1/1 of a meter, and that's also very small.
Yes. Yeah, when you talk about nanotechnology and that super small technology, that is enormous compared to the femto scale. We're talking really, really, really tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they build this sort of lattice structure to contain the simulated universe, and within this simulated universe, they are examining the elements that make up the strong nuclear force so that we can understand what it is and how it works better.
Right.
That's the whole purpose.
Since it's one of the big driving forces of the universe, we want to understand it.
But these physicists said, hey, wait a minute. If this is how we are simulating an entirely fake universe, a very tiny universe, doesn't it stand to reason that some other, like, if we are in
if
fact
we
in
became
a computer
hyper advanced, if we went transhuman, couldn't those transhumans, in fact, use the same technology to simulate an entire universe?
On a big scale.
On a really large scale. On a universal scale.
Yeah, right. Or at least for us, I mean, you could also argue that just to populate a femto-sized universe with even smaller individual units within that femto-sized universe, the idea being that, well, you could create a simulation that is a true universe with inhabitants.
Right.
Intelligent inhabitants. And that if, in fact, we are in a computer simulation, then perhaps there's some way that we could detect if this lattice structure is around our own universe. Yeah, this is where it's getting to the point where it's hard for me to actually explain because it's brain stretching.
Both of our grasps on quantum mechanics are perhaps not as strong as they could be,
and cosmology for that matter, because uh-huh. we're talking about things like cosmic rays. The physicists suggested that perhaps we could observe cosmic rays and really study them in depth and see how they behave within our universe and look for evidence of a lattice structure, which would indicate that some other larger universe had used the same techniques we used to create the femto universes we're making to look at the strong nuclear force to make our own universe.
Right.
And then we'd say, hey, look, there's evidence. We are in a computer simulation. Crap. There are some issues with this. One is that it presumes that any post-human civilization would use the exact same methodology.
Would use the exact same thing that we're using,
yeah.
Right? Correct.
So there's another assumption that said post-human society would allow us to be able to find our own.
Right. That, you know, they wouldn't paint in a nice little backdrop that would prevent us from seeing the seams.
Yeah. Like to put in a patch.
Right.
Or to reset us. Let's go back to Bronze Age, folks. Control or delete. There's also the argument that, well, what if our universe is so large that it is a bounded universe? Because that's the other thing. A lattice structure would also indicate that our universe does have
limits.
It's
finite.
Yeah, it's a finite universe. What if that finite universe is still too big for us to ever be able to see the edges?
Right. Or what if the universe just is finite anyway?
Yeah, it could be that the universe is finite anyway and has nothing to do with the lattice structure. And so there are a lot of objections that people have brought up. But mainly what this approach would allow us to do is if we saw the lattice structure, we could maybe draw some conclusions. But in any other case, like if we didn't see the lattice structure, it doesn't answer any questions.
Right. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that we're not in a computer simulation. So it's interesting, but again, it's just sort of an extension of this thought experiment where, we're kind of getting round to the point that I'm most interested in this whole discussion that, all right, let's say that we are in a computer simulation.
Okay.
Whether we know it or not, it doesn't matter. We don't necessarily need to know that we are, but let's just assume.
Assuming that we are.
That we are. Does that matter? On a day-to-day scale, would it matter if we were in a computer simulation?
Yeah.
Now, if we don't know, it doesn't matter at all.
Uh-huh. I mean, you know, if we had absolute proof of it, then that would be huge. That would be shattering.
Yeah, that would probably cause wars.
Yeah, for all kinds of philosophies and
religions.
And just interpersonal. I mean, within my own head, I would probably need to spend a few days just drooling. Because
this is talking about my normal week. This is what I do. All right, fine. Okay, so now I know something different between me and Lauren.
Learning new stuff.
I agree that if we don't know, there is no difference. Because the rules that we have created for ourselves, but based on our cultures and our society, those haven't changed. If I found out, somehow, if knowledge were given to me personally, out of everyone who's alive, that yes, in fact, you live in a computer simulation. After I had that moment where I upped my drooling capacity for my daily allowance of drooling, I would sit there and think, well, ultimately, this doesn't change anything. I mean, my life still has meaning within the context of the world I live in.
Right. We still need to go get lunch. We still get married. We still die.
Right. I still laugh. I still cry. I still find that Mitchell and Webb look to be absolutely hilarious. And I would really like it if Netflix streaming would bring it back for me. I mean, all of these sort of things would still be true. So I don't think that ultimately it changes anything unless it were something where we could definitively prove it, and then that would change major things. Essentially, a lot of people would have to answer some very tough questions in regards to philosophy and religion,
right?
Particularly, but other things as well. But those two in particular.
Yeah, some very nice philosophy departments would be more or less out of jobs.
Yeah, well,
Or actually, no, they wouldn't.
They're one step away from being out of a job anyway. Come on, we're talking about philosophy here.
Snap.
This is coming from a literature major. Okay. I'm like, did you see, this is off topic, but there was a list, I think, of the most unemployable majors that came out
for
2012.
Oh, no, I did not see that.
Philosophy, I think, was in the top three.
Oh.
Yeah. Literature was in the top 10.
Was it?
Yeah.
Was it? I was creative writing. Do you have any?
Oh, creative writing? I think they didn't even put that in there. It's like, are you Neil Gaiman? No. Get out.
Hey, I'm an editor. I'm working in my field, folks.
That's true. I don't know what my field would be. So I was a medieval literature. I guess I'd be teaching medieval literature if I were in my field. But it's funny that I went into technology podcasting instead. So anyway, ultimately, I don't think it would really matter. There's no way of knowing currently,
right,
one way or the other. So from that perspective,
so from,
obviously,
from a thought
matter.
Exercise, right.
Yeah.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenny, Chief Marketing and Growth Officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time with the customers. That is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
So ultimately, it may or may not matter if we're in a computer simulation, but the other question to ask is, how feasible is it? How would it be possible to actually create a universe on this? What would it take to create a universe on this scale?
Oh, right. And I mean, because simulating something is actually very much more complicated than just doing it.
Yeah.
For example, I was reading one article that cited a number where if you were to take a hard drive and you wanted to create a simulation of that entire hard drive, mm-hmm. you would have to simulate every single atom in it, record its position, its time scale, everything about it. That would be, you know, and every single atom in a hard drive is maybe in 10 to the power of 24 atoms.
Wow, that's a lot of atoms.
A couple, a bunch. But in order to simulate it, you would have to have about 100 bits of information at least on each of those atoms.
Right. So when you think about that, if this world is, or this universe is, a computer simulation, then that means the simulation has to take into account every single object within that world, whether that object is part of something else or an individual object, its position, its if it's moving, its relationship to every other object within that universe, mm-hmm. how that object's behavior, you know, however you want to define that, affects other objects. It's this huge ripple effect.
Are you going down to the atomic scale? Are you going to the subatomic scale? How deep does the rabbit hole go?
Right. Because the other problem here is that as we, the human beings who live right here and now, whether it's a computer simulation or not, get more advanced, we get to learn more about our environment and we get to look even deeper than we could before. So, like, let's go back to the Stone Age. No microscopes, nothing. Like, anything that was beyond our ability to actually see it did not exist in our minds. And then we got more and more advanced, and we were able to suddenly start seeing things that are tinier and tinier. And then we get to the point where we've got electron tunneling microscopes, and we can move individual atoms into mm-hmm. place.
And we can see things that are really far away.
That would mean that the simulation would have to take into account the ability for us to see well beyond what we first
were able to see. Normal perception, right?
Right. So that's kind of incredible to think about it that way. Like, how much power would you have to generate this? Is it something that would be added over time so that, like, you know, someone's checking in every now and then, like, uh-oh, they can see atoms now. All right, well, we got to build the next level down, guys.
Yeah.
Or
like, fire up that extra server. We're going to need it soon.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's some place in this other larger universe's North Carolina, there's another server farm being built. It blows the mind. It becomes one of these things where you, as you start to think about it, you're like, would that even be possible? Now, from a futurist's argument, they might say that in the future we'll be able to do things like harness the power of black holes to do computing, in which case the limitations of computing suddenly seem like a non-problem.
Oh, sure. Or even with quantum computers, which they're already experimenting with.
Yeah.
We've gotten up to 16 qubits?
16 qubits was the last reliable one. But there have been larger ones. The problem with, of course, quantum computers is that as soon as you really observe the state they're in, it collapses, it decoheres, and you end up with a classical computer that is severely underpowered compared to any other normal classical computer. But there are people who are working on that problem. So, yeah, I mean, it may be that reaching such a level of computing power is not possible. And in fact, that was part of Bostrom's point, was that he was not necessarily saying we live in a computer simulation. He was saying there's another way of looking at this. We could look at this as saying transhuman or post-human, in the sense that the futurists have defined it, is an impossibility.
Right.
That we will never get to a point where we have computing power so vast as to be able to simulate an entire universe down to the tiniest detail and have it populated with intelligent creatures.
Right. Or even beyond the feasibility of that, the idea that probably we're going to kill all of each other way before that could
actually
happen.
That was another one of his points, is saying that it's way more likely that any sort of civilization reaching post-human or transhuman status would end up wiping itself out in some sort of cataclysmic event, whether on purpose or by accident. So we could have, hey, we have reached this level of superiority. Now we are going to force our ideological values upon everybody else. And everybody else says, no, you're not. And then we all kill each other. Or we say, hey, what does this button do? Zombie outbreak. Those are the only two possibilities. That's a lie. But no, that's Bostrom's point, is that that could also be a case. It's really a depressing case, but he could say humankind could hit extinction before we hit post-human.
More fun to think about that other thing. But overall,
zombie outbreak, I agree. Walking Dead, man. Right down the street from me.
That's just Atlanta on normal traffic days.
That's true. It's pretty much the office before we get to the coffee machine.
It is. It gets ugly, folks.
A lot of walkers. That's a good point, is that humankind could go extinct. That's one downside. We might not ever be able to reach that level of computational achievement in order to ever simulate a universe. That's, depending upon whom you ask, also a downside.
Mm-hmm.
Or we just might never know. So, yeah,
so
sometimes.
It leads us to explore the question further, really.
Yeah, and we've seen that explored in multiple venues, not just philosophy, not just science, but entertainment.
All over the place, yeah. I mean, going back to a lot of Shakespeare stories we're talking about, really. Like what's the difference between dreams and reality? Midsummer Night's Dream is kind of a big one.
We are such stuff as dreams are made on.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Oh, brave new world to have such people in it. 'Tis new to thee. That's the Tempest right there.
That's our literature major over here.
Yeah, well, you know, I gotta use the degree once in a while.
But perhaps more modern things. A few of you have probably seen The Matrix.
Yeah. I know Kung Fu. I can quote. Let's just keep going. I got it. I got this.
Vanilla Sky.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that one. Yeah, I can't do that one. I haven't seen that documentary.
Or the Spanish version, Abre los Ojos. Do you speak Spanish?
Okay. There we go. That was my...
Total Recall, Inception.
Right. Get to the chopper. That's every other Schwarzenegger movie. I'm sorry.
That's not Inception at all.
No, it's Total Recall.
Total Recall.
First one you said.
I know.
The Inception one would be... That's Inception.
Oh, dear.
Love these movies, by the way. I'm making a lot of fun, but no, these are good points. I mean, you do see this theme come up over and over again. Total Recall. What is real? What is being imagined? Mm-hmm. Is the entire story actually only happening in Quaid? That was his name, right? Quaid's mm-hmm. mind. Or Inception. Are you still within a dream? Are you one level down in a dream? Are you two levels down? At the very end of the movie, is the main character, is he awake?
Is the entire frame still a dream?
Right. Which, and of course, that brings into question something else. This is a good argument that falls within the same sort of thing about being able to tell versus not being able to tell. This is big spoilers for Inception here, obviously. But one of the things they set up in Inception is that one way you can tell if you are in a dream is you have a totem that is specific to you and mm-hmm. behaves a certain way in the real world.
Right.
But in dream space, it does not behave that way.
Right.
Why? Who knows? But
it's convenient physics.
Right. The main character has a top. So if he spins the top and the top stops spinning, he knows he's in the real world. If he's a layer down into a dream world and he spins the top, it just keeps spinning. Mm-hmm. And that's how he can look at a moment and know if he's in a dream or if he's awake.
Right.
There's a problem with this, though. If the whole thing is within a dream, there's nothing to stop the dream world from saying, at a certain level, this top behaves a different way.
Right.
So in other words, even if the top topples over, which end of the movie gives you this kind of idea, is it going to spin?
Is it going to topple? Is it going
to? But even if the top were to topple over, that would not answer the question of whether or not you were in a dream, because it only depends upon if that level is real or not. And if it's not real, if that's just another point of the dream, then all it means is that the behaviors of stuff in one level of the dream behave differently than the others.
Right. And similarly, if our future transhuman selves decided to make it so that we cannot detect whether or not we are in a dream, then...
Yeah, we're kind of stuck.
We're
kind of stuck. But yeah, same thing with The Matrix, the whole idea of creating a universe that is not ideal, because if we created an ideal universe, humans would go, this can't be real. My life stinks. There's no way my life is this awesome. And then we have a universe filled with Jonathan Stricklands. And nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that.
Not even Jonathan Strickland. Look, I'm enough to deal with already. But yeah, no, there's tons of examples. There's a lot in science fiction, obviously.
Because especially since William Gibson and the entire cyberpunk thing became a thing, you know, mm-hmm. and that's sort of our entrance into how, did I just make up a word in French? I don't think that's an actual thing. ever since cyberpunk happened, we've been looking at technology in this fearful way, which we always kind of do in horror films. I think that fiction is a really terrific way for us to work out our anxieties, because we can go like, well, in this scary world, all of these terrible things will happen. However, we're going to have some attractive people in pleather who are going to take care of it for us.
Right. Or die, and die in numerous ways. Yeah, like you said, yeah, it's science fiction and horror are the two genres I think of the most when I think about this kind of mentality. Because I also think of things like other movies. Here's another spoiler, guys. If you're a Joss Whedon fan,
oh no, mm-hmm.
this is a spoiler. So spoiler for Joss Whedon fans, you can skip ahead. But Cabin in the Woods,
oh,
another example of like what is real and what is What is artifice?
Yes, what has been simulated.
Yes, so there you go. Same sort of thing. I don't think that's a huge spoiler because that's revealed early in the movie, but still.
Sure.
At any rate, these are, you know, we've explored this idea in multiple forms of media, whether it's entertainment or also in multiple disciplines, entertainment, science, philosophy. And I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon because obviously there's no way for us to answer this question.
Mm-hmm.
Not unless we detect that lattice structure. And even then you're like, well,
then
who created us?
That could mean anything.
Yeah, that could mean. And also it could be like Inception. We might be 78 levels down from reality.
It could be that marble in the Men in Black.
Yeah, yeah, then, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, we could be a mote of dust upon the nose of a dog in another universe, which in itself is a mote of dust upon the nose of another dog in another universe, which in itself is a mote of dust upon Douglas Adams' pencil as he giggles maniacally and writes another book.
Yes.
Because in that universe, he's still around.
Oh, I like that universe.
I do too. I want to go to there. But, yeah, it's a really interesting question. So, and if you've heard about this whole thing, because it came up in conversations toward the end of 2012, which was kind of interesting because the publication of Bostrom's work was in the early 2000s.
And back in 2003, I think.
Yeah. So, but in this case, it was because the physicists had said, hey, there might be a way for us to find out. Maybe, possibly,
right.
Probably not, but it could happen. and even then, we're going to have to get to a level of technological advancement that is beyond what we have now before we could even hope to detect these cosmic rays and their behavior. But we'll see. I mean, again, I don't think anything's going to change in the long term. You know, there might be some short term freak out if we were ever to find out, but
yeah, but you know, in the end, we are what we are.
I
am what I am.
Thank you, Popeye. And with that, we close this book known as Tech Stuff, the Philosophy, and we will open up a new chapter in the next episode, possibly about a totally different topic. Actually, very likely about a totally different topic. If you guys have any topics you think we should talk about in future episodes of Tech Stuff, I recommend you let us know, because we have not figured out how to read your mind yet. If you would send us an email, our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. You can find our handle there, techstuff, HSW. Lauren and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Badatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every week on Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso, I invite an artist, writer, or politician to come to the table and speak from the heart in ways you probably haven't heard from them before. Some of my favorites are with Tom Hanks, Questlove, and Cate Blanchett. In recent weeks, I talked to actor Dan Levy, director Ava DuVernay, and the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. You can listen to Talk Easy on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.